And today I would like to talk about basically all the problems with Mormonism. As it says here, it's not all gold that glitters, and then we'll see that Joseph Smith was not really a saint person as the Mormons try to represent him, and we will see something about the Mormon scriptures, the circumstances they were written, and the sort of questions about their content. We'll talk about polygamy and contradictory statements of the prophets. It's kind of Mormons believe in continued revelation, and they believe that what the newer prophet says, it has more validity than what the older prophet says. But I mean, you would at least expect that they don't contradict each other. Yes, so there can be some new revelation, but if they say something about doctrine 100 years ago and now they say something else about the doctrine and it's completely opposite, I mean, it's not just revealing something new, it's changing what was revealed. And that's the thing for next week. We'll be talking about doctrine, and they will notice that they are definitely not Christian, because their doctrine, it's just, it uses lots of Christian terms, images, but what they believe about almost everything in the doctrine is different than what we as Christians believe. So basically we'll see that Mormonism is more like Scientology or Christian Science or some other strange cult. And it kind of came up into being in the 1900s, where America was full of various strange trends and religions, and all of the, there were a lot of new churches that started, or different denominations that started in the 1900s, and some of them just died out and others survived, like Mormonism. So, about Joseph Smith. So, his character is put into question a lot, and one thing about Joseph Smith that he was into treasure seeking, which was a very popular endeavor at that time, and there were lots of people who believed that they could find special stones, and they would give them ability to, like, sort of give them some type of occult powers, or allow them to see the future, or find answers to questions. So, and this practice was so popular that it's actually there were laws against that. Yes, so anybody who was doing, for example, a seer stone divination, that was a crime. It was a misdemeanor, but it was still a crime, and they could be put to court. And there is even a court record from 1826 where Joseph Smith was caught while doing something with those seer stones, and he was sentenced to pay a fine. Another thing about Joseph Smith is that like the most important thing that Mormons start is the vision of Joseph Smith, the first vision. But there are multiple accounts of what happened during that vision and what Joseph Smith saw. There are at least four accounts which are like full of detail, which Joseph Smith reported at various times, and they are really different from one another. And altogether, people can find 10 different various accounts of that vision. And that's just one example. And there were lots of people when Joseph Smith was starting sharing his religion with the people around, family and neighbors. People just knew what kind of person he was. And then nowadays, around that time, a lot of people made even sworn statements about the true character of Joseph Smith as soon as he was starting popularizing his religion. And just people didn't want to believe him at the place where he lived. So that's probably one of the reasons why he moved. And then he just found other people of who were also if kind of occult, various spiritual things, and he just found like-minded people, and they moved, and then that's how the whole religion grew. So another thing that really, and I'll talk about it later, it's about, and it's sort of testimony to his character, is that how he acquired some of his 34 wives. Okay, so Mormon scriptures. The Book of Mormon is pretty fascinating. And what you have here as an image, these are the, I think these are several sentences from the plates that Joseph Smith had. And he supposedly copied some sentences and he gave to someone to take it to a university professor to verify that these are actually some Egyptian writings. These are supposedly characters in what's called a Reformed Egyptian. It's supposed to be like an improvement on Egyptian hieroglyphics that allow them to write a lot of content in a very condensed space. Because they say it wasn't written in Hebrew or some other language because it would take way more space on those golden plates, and it was a very compact language. So supposedly a professor at Columbia University confirmed that it was indeed something Egyptian. But when later people asked him, did you confirm it? And he said, no, I didn't say anything to confirm that it's actually in some type of Egyptian writing. But Mormons still claim that this is kind of verified as having Egyptian origin. I mean, if you look at it, you really notice certain characters which are very similar to some English letters, and certainly like Egyptian writers wouldn't come up with this sort of fancy-looking H. It really looks like something made up, like, for example, this character or a D with additional dots and stuff like that. People came up with other alphabets from languages that don't exist. For example, for the Lord of the Rings, there is an entire alphabet, and I think people came up with alphabet for Klingons and stuff like that. And they make more sense. They are more sort of coherent than this alphabet that Joseph Smith came up with. Another thing about the book is, so Joseph Smith had those plates, and he started translating those plates with the help of his first scribe, Martin Harris. And wife of Martin Harris was really suspicious of this whole endeavor, because Martin Harris had to invest some money sort of towards translation and publication of the book. And his wife was very suspicious, and she was like bugging him whole time. I mean, you just wasting our money and so on. So Martin Harris eventually decided to convince Joseph Smith to let him take the 116 pages that they translated first, and he took them home, and somehow they got lost. He was supposed to show it only to his wife, and apparently he showed it to some other people, and eventually somehow they were in a closed drawer, and they vanished. What's interesting is if Joseph Smith actually translated these things from the plates, it would have been trivial to just go back and retranslate. I mean, he still had the plates, and then he could have translated them again. However, Joseph Smith didn't do it. What he said is, I'm not going to retranslate the same pages because evil people will go and take those 616 pages that were translated earlier, and they will make changes, and then they will come back to me and say, oh, you see, you're a liar because you translated first time this way and a second time this way, yes? So, obviously, being a crooked man, probably that he was, he realized that he was in a bind, because if those 116 pages were actually found later, people would have noticed that it's something different than the second translation. So, So Joseph Smith decided to translate a different set of plates about a similar story, but this was kind of from a book on the plates which had a more religious character, which didn't have that much detail as the original 116 pages. So the other thing, if you look at the Book of Mormon, it has lots of passages which are like just word for word from King James Version. What's interesting is, supposedly this was translation from the original plates, yes? And then we have two verses. So this is from the King James Bible, and this is from the Book of Mormon. And in the King James Version, it reads, for example, "Nevertheless, the dimness shall not be such as was in her vexation." We notice that here there are some italics. So the actual Hebrew text would read, "Nevertheless, the dimness not such as in her vexation." There were some words missing in the Hebrew, and the translators for the King James Version added those English words to allow it to be read more fluently, but they put them in italics to indicate this was not in the original, yes? So this is not the part of the inspired text, the words in the italics. However, when we read the Book of Mormon, we notice that, Joseph Smith was translating from the plates, yes? And the things which were on the plates, apparently the words which were added in 1600-something to the King James Version, they were already there on the plates, yes, in 400 A.D. when these things were written. And of course, Mormons has explanation for it, so that that's understandable because the translators of King James Version, they were kind of inspired, so they picked the right words to fill in here, which were missing, and that's confirmed because that's what was on the plates, yes? So they have answers like that. Another thing in that particular passage, they added the word, "by the way of the Red Sea beyond Jordan and Galilee." Actually, this doesn't make sense because it talks about the Jordan and Galilee. So if the sea that they are talking about is either Mediterranean or the Sea of Galilee, that passage definitely wouldn't be talking about the Red Sea, which is like 700 miles to the south, but probably Joseph Smith didn't know the geography, and he just filled in something Red Sea when he was dictating it. So obviously, King James Version, we know by now it had translation errors. Some of them were translation errors. Sometimes they didn't have the right manuscripts. They had a smaller set of manuscripts to translate from. And what's interesting, those translation errors are present in the Book of Mormon. So it's again kind of strange. If the plates were like the original trustworthy source, why did Joseph Smith translate it exactly with the same errors as in King James version of the Bible? And then it's interesting where the modern translations talk, for example, about wild goats. The first translation of King James Bible, the one that Joseph Smith had, it used the word satyrs, yes? So, and they were put just into the translation, which is, again, kind of strange. And overall, if you look at the language that's used, so Joseph Smith was translating those plates, and he was translating from some Egyptian Reformed language or something like that into, you would assume he would translate these things into the language of his own time, so that people could read. However, the English that it was translated to was the English of the King James version of the Bible, which was like 200 years before James Smith's time. And it's really strange, why would he pick a particular style? Probably they have he wanted to conform to his style or something, but it's also strange. So overall, if you look at all these things, the simplest answer is that he just took the King James version of the Bible and he just copied things over. It explains everything. If you take any other theory, then you have to really look far from explanation. How is it that we see actually things like we see in the Book of Mormon? Okay, other problems with Mormon scriptures. So the Book of Mormon is not the only scripture that the Mormons believe is inspired. Another book is the Book of Abraham, and it's part of the set of books called Pearl of Great Price. And the way Mormons came into possession of it is that there was an exhibition with various Egyptian artifacts traveling through the U.S. around that time, and Joseph Smith became familiar with... No, don't think it. He became... I've forgotten. Anyways, Joseph Smith came into possession of some of those papyri with the writings, and this is exactly the same copy that Joseph Smith had, because, you see, it's a papyri, and it was... glued onto a sheet of paper, and then somebody filled in the missing pieces with what they thought should have been on this specific image. So Joseph Smith went and translated the text, and what we now have is the Book of Abraham. It's a story of when Abraham was visiting Egypt on the way to Canaan. We know from the Bible that he came first to Canaan and then traveled to Egypt and then returned back. And this book describes that story and what Abraham did then and the things that Abraham said. And it's actually a very important book for Mormons because it contains certain parts of the doctrine which are only mentioned in that book. So one thing is, for example, the concept of God organizing a universe from the universe we live in from pre-existing matter. So, because Mormons don't believe in creation ex nihilo, they believe that the matter and spirit always existed and then just gods are able to arrange it into earth, planets, people, and so on. So that particular part of doctrine, it's described only in the Book of Abraham. So the original of the Book of Abraham was lost in 1877 in a fire in Chicago. And kind of it was convenient for the Mormons that it got lost because just around that time the Egyptologists, or whatever they are called, they managed to translate the hieroglyphics. And they were able to start reading Egyptian writings. So, for example, in the Book of Abraham, Joseph Smith only included the pictures. He didn't include the writings, yes? But later, when people came into possession of the original text which was found, they were able to read this text. And these were just like standard Egyptian funeral writings about somebody going to meet the gods and stuff like that. There is nothing about any Abraham or anything. And actually the pictures that... So the drawings that were in this particular papyri, they were pretty standard drawings. So there's other Egyptian writings which have almost identical drawings. But you see that in this one there is a head missing. So Joseph Smith added a human head. But in all of the other drawings, actually there is a head of like a, what is it, a wolf or like always Egyptian gods who would have animal heads. So there was a human and this was a god next to a human and that being a god would have an animal head. But this part was missing here, so Joseph Smith just drew in a human head. What's interesting that there is a bird here and that represents a soul and Joseph Smith, this part is missing, so he drew a head of a bird. But actually it would have a human head because it represents a soul. So it's very fishy, the whole thing. And of course, Mormons have an explanation for everything. And they say that actually Joseph Smith did not do what we would understand as a standard translation of this text. He sort of interpreted as a kind of revelation. So he didn't actually translate the hieroglyphics, but he had those papyri and he wrote down a revelation based on that set of papyri, and that just solves all their problems. Next. Oh, so the Book of Mormon, when you open on the first page, it has two sets of signatures of witnesses, and there is a first set of there are three witnesses, and these were Oliver Cowdery, Martin Harris, and David Whitmer. So Martin Harris was the first scribe, and then Oliver Cowdery was the second scribe. And what's interesting, Mormons say that, okay, we have those statements of those witnesses, but actually there is never, nowhere a document with proper signatures of these people, something else would look like something signed by those actual people. The closest to what we have is something that Joseph Smith wrote, and basically these are not the signatures of these people, these are the names of those people that Joseph Smith wrote, yes? So there's like this statement to which they affirm, and there are those signatures, but these are just what Joseph Smith wrote, yes? There is nowhere a document with the actual signatures. On the other hand, these people, they never contradicted it. Yeah, they sometimes went away from the Mormon Church. They were against later teachings of Joseph Smith, but they never denied it. One thing is the first set of witnesses, what they were testifying to is not actually seeing these things or touching the plates, but they are more testifying to a vision. So we testify that we had a true vision and an angel showed us those plates. So they didn't physically saw them. There is another set of eight witnesses, and they do claim that they saw and handled those plates. One thing is that frequently the way it's described that they handled a box with the plates and it was covered with a cloth and they could just feel that there were plates inside. So they also didn't actually see them. And all of those people were either members of family or close friends or people who invested in publishing the Book of Mormon. What's very interesting that there is another book, and it's called Book of the Law of the Lord, and it was also translated from the plates, and it was translated from the plates that were found, I think, somewhere in Vermont. And they were found by James Strang, and he was also a Mormon, an early sort of member of the church, and he believed that he had another revelation, and then he found another set of plates, and then he should be the successor of Joseph Smith. And then he also translated those plates that supposedly that he found, and he had also eight witnesses for his plates, yes? So for some reason, Mormons don't believe the witnesses of James Strang. His church is not, there are still some, maybe a few hundred people surviving in the church of James Strang. But they do believe in those witnesses. So it's for whatever reason, people can testify to the truth of something that you can't really give it much credence. What's next? Okay, now regarding the content of the Book of Mormon. So I explained a little bit about the Book of Mormon 2 weeks ago, and it describes pretty complex history, yes, starting a few thousand years ago to a few thousand years before Christ and ending around 400 A.D., and it describes a big civilization. Yes? So if you look at just of the records of the Book of Mormon, there were at least 1.5 million people in all those nations described there. And it describes massive battles, like there was 130,000 killed just on one side. And by the end, it looks like about 250,000 people were killed in various battles. So I mean, 1.5 million seems like small by our current standards, but at that time, that was a sort of size of civilization of Egypt, on larger than a civilization of Hebrews. It was like Persians and all the other civilizations. They left lots of artifacts, like archaeologists can keep digging and digging for years and finding the artifacts. However, we don't have much of any artifacts of that would confirm the Book of Mormon. And certainly, originally, the way the early Mormons were presenting this thing, it seemed like those Nephites and Lamanites, they would be all over the America, North and South. But that isn't confirmed by archaeological records. So now the answer that they find for this, they propose a limited geography model, what they call, is that the events described in the Book of Mormon took over a relatively small area of America. And there are two proposed areas. One is sort of like a Yucatan Peninsula. And the reason why Mormons like to, at least some of the Mormons suggest this as the area where the Book of Mormon action takes place, is because they have found all those really cool pyramids and archaeological artifacts and an advanced civilization, and that's why I say, okay, this was the civilization from the Book of Mormon. The other theory is that the whole history of the Book of Mormon takes place somewhere along around the Lake Ontario and Lake Erie. And that's so if you read through the Book of Mormons, you notice sort of like a description of two seas and a narrow passage between the seas, and there's like waters in that passage, and there are like certain locations of mountains and so on. It really reflects the geography of Lake Ontario and Lake Erie. And what's really funny is that there are some small cities in that area which have names which are similar to the names from the Book of Mormon. And that's exactly the area where Joseph Smith lived and traveled. So it's quite possible that he just took it was easy for him to come up with a history that described some area that he was familiar with. But of course, I mean, that's not the explanation that Mormons are giving. It just, they say, oh, it's possible here because the geographical features are matching the description from the book. Okay, what else do we have? So Book of Mormon has a lot of details about those cultures, and it describes the tools that they use, buildings that they build, the animals and plants that they had. What's interesting is that a lot of these things were not there around that time. And they were brought mainly by, after discovery of America, by Columbus. So Book of Mormon talks about horses and sheep and pigs and silk and chariots and iron swords, and then there's no record of things like that ever existing on the American continent before discovery by Christopher Columbus. They didn't have any wheeled vehicles. That's why we see, like, in all those movies when Indians are traveling, they are just dragging things on the ground behind them because they didn't have a wheel. They would use iron, but they never really perfected making of iron, so they were not really able to make any significant tools out of iron, and certainly not iron swords. And of course, now when you ask Mormons, okay, what about all these things, they say, oh, these were not horses, this was something like horses, and these were not sheep, this was something that looked like sheep, and these were not pigs, but something that looked like pigs. And it wasn't a silk, but it was something that, when translated, silk was the best word to pick for it, and they find all of those excuses. What else? Oh, yeah. So another thing is, so I showed it 2 weeks ago. There was a big race of people living in North America before Leahy came from from Israel around 600 before Christ. And but the other sort of civilization, they just died. They had wars among themselves. So basically, what the Book of Mormon says is that, and it was even up to until the 1991 edition, they would say the Lamanites were the principal ancestors of the American Indians. So basically, they say that the family of Lehi, they settled the entire continent, and these their descendants, they are the American Indians that we can see now. And of course, we know that the descendants of Lehi, the Nephites and the Lamanites, they came from Israel, so they were Hebrews, yes? And at that time, I mean, there was no knowledge when Joseph Smith wrote it. There was no way to verify it. But now we know that particular groups of people have a particular genetic markers, and then you could see if the certain group of people is really a descendant of another group of people, and or maybe it's a mixture of other groups of people. And people have done research on it, and they see, is there any correspondence, any possibility that any of the American Indians are somehow really related to the Hebrews, and there's absolutely no match. So, and of course, Mormons say that. So that's why they changed. If you look, have an edition of the Book of Mormon after 1981, it will say are among the ancestors of the American Indians. So they no longer say principal, but they say among. So they say, oh, the Nephites and the Lamanites, they were just a few tribes in the America, and there were lots of other tribes, and that's why sort of their DNA sort of mixed in, and that's why you can no longer discover any distinct Hebrew traits among the Indians. So that's kind of the answer that they have. And they do have answer to everything. If you go, like, to the website, the official website, they... So there's official and there's also kind of non-official website where it's almost like a wiki where Mormons just explain all those problems with the Book of Mormons and other things, and they have answer for everything. Now a little about polygamy. What's interesting is that Book of Mormon... says is against polygamy. So there is, it's against but allows for it, yes? So there is this, the main passage is from the Book of Jacob. So the Book of Jacob is the third book in the Book of Mormon. And it's not that the Jacob of the Bible is the Jacob who was the brother of Nephi, and he lived in America. So it says that there shall not any man among you have save it be one wife. So that's in verse 27, but there is verse 30 says, for if I will save the Lord of hosts, raise up seed unto me, I will command my people. So the way Mormons read the verse 30 is that if God wants at certain periods of time, they may be allowed or even commanded to have multiple wives. What's interesting is that Joseph Smith started to or was commanded to have multiple wives, supposedly commanded, very early on, even before it became an formal doctrine of the church. So we see that it was... in the church, it was publicly sanctioned between 1852 and 90, which was about 20 years after Joseph Smith starting practicing it. The picture here is not of Joseph Smith, but Joseph F. Smith. That was the nephew of Joseph Smith, and that's his family and all his wives. So Joseph Smith himself had 34 wives, and... I should mention also another thing. So if you read other books of Mormon doctrine, it clarifies that if polygamy is allowed, and even then when it was sanctioned, there were some rules, yes? So, for example, you're not allowed to take a second wife, a woman who was a wife of another man who was a widow, for example, yes? And there were some other rules regarding it. And what's interesting is that Joseph Smith did not obey by those rules, which they even have for polygamy. So Joseph Smith had, as I said, 34 wives, and 11 of them were married to other living men. So they were like, so these women then had two husbands, and frequently those husbands, they would go like on some missions, spreading the news of Mormonism, and then Joseph Smith was their husband while their other husbands were traveling on mission. So 11 were married to other men, 7 of them were under 18, and the youngest one was 14 years old. And if you read, there are several websites really where you can read a lot about polygamy, and then there are stories of some of those women, yes, and when you read, you notice that a lot of them were really like coerced into marrying Joseph Smith, because he would come to them and say that he had a vision from God, and that God commanded him that he has to marry her, yes, and if she doesn't obey the command, then bad things will happen either to her or to Joseph Smith, so, I mean, it was just like, was impossible for them to refuse because they were already part of community, and if they disobeyed the prophet, and so he was a pretty good manipulator. What else? It's interesting also how the polygamy ended. So apparently God commanded Mormons to have multiple wives. So according to Jacob 30, around that time. But polygamy was illegal in the U.S., and eventually the Utah became a proper U.S. territory with all the U.S. laws over it, and the federal government was really not happy with the polygamy that was happening there, and they just decided, okay, you either stop it or we'll seize all the property of the Mormon church. And just about when the feds were to seize all the property, certainly the at that time president or the main prophet Woodruff, he had a vision, and he said, okay, now we shouldn't do polygamy anymore. And it was and then they stopped. So Mormons are known for having convenient visions at convenient times, because there was another more modern times, they didn't allow black people to be part of the, let's say, clergy of the church, and that again caused problems. And I don't remember exactly what the federal government wanted to do with them, but they were in some trouble, and they also had a vision, and it suddenly turned out that black people were allowed to be prophets and be clergy and so on. So that's about polygamy, which is strange. Certainly, if you start reading about how Joseph Smith invented it, it really doesn't look like something that was given to him by God, but something that he just wanted and came up with a nice story to justify it. So we talked about the Book of Mormon. We talked about Joseph Smith. Next thing, prophets. So there are multiple contradictory revelations in their doctrine. One example is the God Adam doctrine. So Brigham Young, the very important person in the Mormon church, he used to teach that Adam was actually God the Father. So He said, when our father Adam came into the Garden of Eden, he came into it with a celestial body and brought Eve, one of his wives, with him. He helped to make and organize this world. He is Michael the Archangel, the Ancient of Days, about whom holy men have written and spoken. He is our father and our God, and the only God with whom we have to do. So that's basically what Brigham Young, who was the president and the prophet of the church for quite a few years, and that's what he used to teach. I don't know, it's just very confusing. Yeah, that's what he said. I mean, it, maybe it's like a different names on the which he appears in the Bible. It's just lots of made-up stuff. That's my opinion. And then they just write something, and then some other people have to find some theology of doctrine that explains what somebody said, unless it's so confusing and convoluted that they say, oh, this person actually wasn't right at that time. But they will first try to defend all those statements until they are not defensible, and then they just abandon them. And so if we look at more recent president in 1976, Spencer Kimball said in multiple statements that this theory is just nonsense, and that's not what they believe. So they believe that Adam and Eve were created by God the Father. So, I mean, yeah. Okay. So it's actually, for Roman Catholic Church, it's very difficult to sort of deny what some previous popes said, because they do try to be consistent. Mormons, they always... So basically, popes don't say things like on TV or write something. Almost everything that popes write have to come in some encyclica or some official statement. So you don't have like things that popes just said in passing. With Mormons, it's kind of difficult to distinguish what was said in what capacity of that person, yes? Which then later what they do is that they explain the things that they like is that, oh, that's basically revelation and that's part of our doctrine. And if there is something questionable, they said, oh, he was just saying it in passing or he wasn't saying it in a capacity of. And I'll just give an example later, for example, how Joseph Smith made one mistake, and they find a very easy explanation for it. So one thing is there are, so certainly those prophets seem to sometimes say things that aren't true and are even contradicted by the church at a later time. And Joseph Smith also made a whole bunch of prediction about the future, which, as usual with predictions, if you predict things in a vague enough way, they will always come true or they will always fail. I mean, depending who is looking at it. It's almost like reading a horoscope in a newspaper, you always find that the horoscope matches you. I mean, that's the art of writing a horoscope or the art of writing a prophecy, yes? I mean, if you're vague enough, you can always explain that something like that will happen. Yeah, but then they will explain that, I mean, yeah, maybe he didn't mean the slavery everywhere, the slavery... I mean, yeah, you see, it's like... So he will predict a war, like, unless we repent, there will be a war... And there will always be some war in whatever within 30 years from now, yes? So, that's it. And they do have like those weird teachings. For example, I read yesterday about, like for example, when the Lamanites and Nephites, they sinned, God turned them black, yes? So their skin was black. And then when Jesus came and preached gospel to them, then they... skin started to become nice and fairer, and then eventually in a generation they became white again because they repented. These were all in the writings of their prophets, yes? But nowadays the church sort of will discount, oh, they just sort of wrote, and then they didn't mean white, they mean pure, yes? So they became pure and not white. You can always find an explanation. So one thing about, we are almost at the end of our time, but I'm just a few, 2 points. One thing kind of showing that Joseph Smith was not really a prophet and how Mormons explain his failures is the Kinderhook plates hoax. So basically, when the Mormons were really getting strong in Illinois, somebody just decided to trap them. And a person created a set of, I think there were like 6 or 12 small golden plates, and they etched things on those plates. And then they said that they had a vision, and God told them that there were these plates hidden. And they dug up the plates, and they brought them to Joseph Smith and asked them to translate it. And Joseph Smith looked at those plates, and then eventually he translated them, and it turned out that it was a history of some guy who was some descendant of Pharaoh and stuff like that. And it was a pure hoax, and still Joseph Smith somehow didn't discover that it was a hoax, but he believed, oh, this must be some... Obviously, he knew that it was a hoax because his first plates were a hoax, yes? So he somehow diplomatically said something that these are some translation because he didn't try to be stupid or whatever. But anyway, so this whole story was in the history of a Mormon church for a very long time. But eventually, when later those plates were rediscovered and people were able to examine those plates, it was determined with certainty that it was a hoax. They were just made using sort of modern means, and then the church kind of scrapped it from their history, and they said that Joseph Smith actually, how did they say? They say that Joseph Smith did not take up the matter with the Lord like he did with the Book of Mormon and the Book of Abraham, yes? So Joseph Smith didn't approach translation of it properly, and that's why he got kind of sort of fooled. And that's the explanation, yes. And that's kind of what they are generally doing is if there was some mistake made, it's just, oh, they maybe were not doing things properly when not asking the Lord, were not acting as a real prophet, but just a mere person and so on. And there are some other funny things, like Brigham Young taught that Moon and the Sun were inhabited. So there's no question of it, yes. I mean, and Joseph Smith also reported that Moon is inhabited and actually gave some description of what the people of the Moon were like and so on. And, I mean, that was a popular thing of that time in 19th century, like Jules Verne and the channels on the Mars, so people were kind of believing in... They just didn't know enough about science to know that it's impossible to live on the moon, but they just, they made up the stories, and of course Mormons have explanations for all of this. And that's kind of it. I mean, you can't really, like, talk to a Mormon and, like, just point all of those fallacies because they won't listen, and they say, oh, it's not really important, it's about what you feel in your heart, and other things, yes, and they would just dismiss it. Because all of their prophets and presidents and the whole church has answer for this, or has like some plausible answer so that people don't think that they have to examine it forever. So we're running out of time. It's if you read about Mormons, you find a lot of stories, and some are kind of more plausible, some are less plausible. There was one story that I read was about somebody who made a sort of an official account of what he was once talking to Joseph Smith about in some bar or pub about how he found the plates, and supposedly Joseph Smith was once in the woods and he found there something really interesting, like a very special stone. And it's quite plausible because he was looking for various types of seer stones where they would dig in the ground and they would find unusual stones and they would think they had special properties. So one day he found something like that really big stone, brought it home, and then at home they asked him, like, so what did you find? And then he just didn't want to show him and said, I found the golden plates. And then his family says, oh, tell us more about it. And then supposedly Joseph Smith then just went ahead with the whole story, and just people started believing him. So that's what at least one person who spoke to Joseph Smith claims, that's how this whole thing started. It's just kind of almost like a joke, and then people just believed it, and then Joseph Smith went ahead with it, which which sounds plausible. I mean, if you are a type of person that you kind of like a con artist, then it's like in your heart you are a con artist and you also believe in some sort of spiritual stuff, you just go ahead with it. I mean, certainly if you read about how he approached polygamy, it was all to his advantage. It wasn't, he was just manipulating those people and just making up a doctrine just to justify his own desires. So next week we'll talk about doctrine, which is very interesting. It's very science fiction. I didn't mention it. I can talk. So basically, the Book of Mormon, it matches in an account, matches a book that was published around that time by some Episcopalian priest. He just wrote a fiction book, sort of semi-fiction fantasy book, which has pretty much the whole story of the Book of Mormon, just slightly different. What's interesting is that the second scribe who was writing, Oliver Cowdery, was writing down the Book of Mormon. He was from the church of that priest who wrote this first book. So he was familiar with the other sort of fantasy book, which was a very popular genre. You probably, I don't know who saw the movie, the John Carter, The Princess of Mars. That action also takes place in the 19th century where somebody like travels to Mars. People did write a lot of books like that around that time, and then it's possible that Oliver Cowdery just like was the like real fellow soul to Joseph Smith, and they just made this up. 15 million? No, but they don't really believe this because they don't. They hear different things. Yes, they hear what people hear in any other church here. Yes, like be good to your family and like be a good person, and that's. They have very nice Christmas songs and carols. And there is a lot of like small splinter churches. Like for example, this James Strong. There is like maybe few churches somewhere in Vermont, and they are called themselves Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And then the official church is D, and they are calling themselves without a D. But anyway, they call themselves the same, but they are called also Strangites from the name of the founder, and they are still there. And there's lots of like small enclaves. Okay, we're done.